Thank you very much, Morton. I might say that having just completed or being in the process of completing myself a research project into the State Department and how it functions, I totally endorse everything Morton said. It was a very accurate picture of the way in which American foreign policy is made. I would point out one positive sign, which was about 6 months ago, the State Department did appoint an ambassador to the Heritage Foundation. And it's no joke, they actually did. And that is a sign, it seems to me, that they were perhaps willing to extend diplomatic recognition to conservatives. Our next speaker is someone that I first heard address the Philadelphia Society a couple of years ago in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside Washington. He's very articulate indeed. He has been very active in promulgating conservative doctrines in the academic community. He has spent a good deal of time immersed in both Yale and Harvard, which suggests that a man can rise above his origins. He is at present conducting two different courses, one at each of these universities. He's a visiting instructor at Yale on constitutions and history, and also a teaching fellow at Harvard, where he is teaching democratic theory. He also, in addition to his academic pursuits, in a sense personifies the theme of this discussion, because he began here in Toronto, got his early schooling here, and then went on to study in the States. Please welcome at this time to address the topic, Can the West Defend Itself, Mr. David Frum. David?
I may send you all scurrying to the washrooms, because the message I have is one that is usually very uncongenial to conservative gatherings. It's be of good cheer. And I know that you never quite get the enthusiastic replies from the audience that you do when you have good news as when you have imminent disaster to report. But my own view, at least of the world of foreign policy, is an optimistic one. I'm not, however, going to give you a global perspective on reasons for good cheer. I'm going to simply talk about SDI, or as somebody who's just maybe too exposed to the media, I can't shake the habit of calling it Star Wars.
Okay.
I think the first thing that our American visitors may wonder is, where does a Canadian get off talking Star Wars? This is our project. I don't think it's inappropriate for a foreigner to discuss it. Caspar Weinberger last year invited the Allies to participate in the development of Star Wars technology. So far, there have been formal acceptances from among the most important, West Germany, Japan, and the United Kingdom. There have also been sort of tepid semi-acceptances from many countries, including Canada, where Brian Mulroney has not given any official endorsement to it, but has said that he thinks it's a good idea and that Canadian companies will not be hindered from getting as far into and as deep into the American gravy train as they possibly can. But it's especially, I think, appropriate for a non-American to discuss Star Wars, because I think the real strategic importance of Star Wars is not so much its implications for American security as for the security of America's allies. Let me explain. The fundamental strategic equation of the modern world consists in two threats. The Americans threaten the Russians. If you mess with Western Europe, we'll blow you to pieces. That threat was first articulated in the immediate post-war period, and it remained credible into the late 60s. Beginning in the late 60s, the Soviets were able to credibly reply, you will blow us to pieces if we mess with Western Europe, and we'll blow you to pieces. The net result of that is that while both superpowers are deterred from committing aggression against each other, the Soviet ability and propensity to commit aggression upon Western Europe and other U.S. allies, but Western Europe is, of course, the most vital, is not deterred. Strategic defense, if it fulfills its promises, by making the American homeland more secure, by essentially defeating the Russian counter-threat, allows the American threat of you mess with Western Europe to stand. That means that American, if if all works as we hope it will, American nuclear superiority will again counter Soviet conventional superiority, as it did throughout the 50s and most of the 60s. For that reason, Star Wars is a matter of vital concern to Europeans, Japanese, Canadians, Australians, and dare I say it, New Zealanders, perhaps even of more vital concern to us than it is to you, considering that the threat to us to Canada is obviously much less than it is to West Germany, but into Canada, in turn, it's greater than it is to the United States. Finally, I think a non-American can take an issue, an interest in strategic defense, simply as an observer of the way the world is going. There was a flurry of debate during the 1984 presidential campaign that Gary Hart complained that it is too often true that technology drives strategy, and strategy should instead drive technology. But the fact of the matter is that technology always does drive strategy, and people who follow technological developments can't help but notice that for better or for worse, and perhaps it may well yet turn to be worse, that Star Wars and related technologies, strategic defense, are what's coming. And those of us who rely on American security guarantees for our safety have to understand that and have to come to terms with it. Having said all that, I think it is appropriate in a gathering like this to issue some cautions about the standard conservative position on strategic defense. I think it's too often true for Americans in general, all Americans, liberals and conservatives, that the goal of foreign policy seems to be to arrive in a world in which foreign policy will no longer be necessary, either through the vehicle of the United Nations or through international law or through something that will make the external world just like the internal world. It's regulated by law, custom, decent people getting together and arriving at voluntary agreements. I think it's also too often true for conservatives that policy choices that in themselves contain neither right answers in any absolute sense nor wrong answers in any absolute sense, the only question is what works, and that I think is paradigmatically true of national security, become infused with a kind of messianic hope that if we can only participate in this particular foreign policy adventure, that the world will somehow become a qualitatively better place than it is now. And I'm simply afraid, and maybe this isn't of good cheer, I consider good cheer, that Star Wars delivers nothing so apocalyptic as that. It neither fulfills the direst predictions of its opponents that it will imminently blow the world to pieces or cause the Russians to launch a preemptive strike or bankrupt the United States Treasury. Nor will it, I'm afraid, substantiate the hopes of its most enthusiastic friends that it will put an end to the nuclear issue. Nuclear bombs will always be here. Star Wars is not an answer to the nuclear bomb, but an ongoing superpower rivalry and competition in which one incremental technological bit will be applied to an existing technological base. The rival will respond with his own incremental technological bit, and we will have a perpetual competition, as we will so long as these two systems are both here, so long as the Russians are going to want the whole world, and so long as we're not prepared to let them have it. We are stuck in this race. Well, that sounds a bit grim. Let me say something that is a little bit less grim. It isn't clear that this is really any different from what has prevailed on the Central Front for the last 30 years. And what has prevailed on the Central Front for the last 30 years is, I think, good news. We have held off Soviet aggression since 1945, in which time the gross national product of the free world has grotesquely exceeded that of the communist world. And if we've given continual peace along the Central Front, will continue to exceed it more and more and more. And the hope is that in time that we indeed bury them. But in urging us to get the messianic view of strategic defense out of our system, I really do want to appeal to people when they see in the newspapers that it has come up at Geneva as a matter of discussion, or that President Reagan in a speech has said that if we get an adequate offer from the Soviets, of course we'd be willing to give it up, not to leap on people who say things like that as traitors to the conservative cause. Of course, if you get an adequate counteroffer to strategic defense, you would give it up. The question is, what would count as an adequate counteroffer? And I think it's very simple what an adequate counteroffer would be. It would be the the elimination of the Soviet offensive missile system. But and if they are prepared to offer that, I think that any conservative should be willing to say, indeed, we would trade strategic defense for that. And any conservative who made that deal should not be branded as a traitor to the cause of a strong national defense and a strong Western defense. Let me explain briefly where I think Canada stands on strategic defense. Brian Mulroney perceives himself to have, perhaps wrongly, a dilemma that, given the fact that he is coping with a country where the articulate classes have an anti-Americanism that is apparently ineradicable, that he felt he had a choice of between two initiatives. One is his initiative towards something like continental free trade, and the second would be increased support for American foreign policy efforts. He seems to have chosen the first. Whether that was a real choice or not, I don't know. It seems that he's taking as much grief as he's ever going to take, that the abuse he's taken does seem to be finite. You're taking all they have to dish out, you might as well take some more. But he didn't seem to feel that this abuse was finite. He thought there was plenty more in store, and he chickened out, and has given a tepid endorsement to Star Wars, but not a very enthusiastic one. He has, however, allowed Canadian companies to participate. That, I'm sure, will thrill the United States Congress to the end to discover that they can ladle out some of the gravy to non voters of the North of the 49th parallel. There was a story in the Globe and Mail, allegedly Canada's national newspaper, yesterday that people would pick up if they have seen that because of interest. During the 1984 election campaign, John Turner, who, if we were to have them both here and look into the inner recesses of their soul, would probably prove to be a more conservative person than Brian Mulroney. John Turner had it proposed to him by the echelons of the Liberal Party that he turn strategic defense into, or Canada's non-participation in strategic defense, into a major issue that he campaigned on peace. And according to the bulk of it, recently published book called The Bigger Northern Party, and according to the Party Mail, Turner said, 1 minute, I have to consult with someone. Picked up the telephone and called George Schultz and asked him, what do you think of Star Wars? And Schultz said, it's a great idea. Turner then went back and said, well, I've known George Schultz for a long time. He's a reliable guy. He wouldn't steer me wrong on a thing like this. And then to the disgust of his party refused to make an issue out of strategic defense. I like this story because I think it nicely shows up the kind of weirdness of Canadian politics. This afternoon explaining to an American who's here, a very intelligent person, why it is that a conservative party and a liberal party tell you absolutely, that those two labels tell you absolutely nothing about the content of it, and how it's possible for a conservative party to be led by somebody who's completely non-conservative, and how it is that a liberal party can be led by somebody who, in secret recesses of his soul, is really quite conservative, but then proceeds to act really quite left-wing. I think that story, it nicely illustrates it. Star Wars in Canada is in fact not really a very touchy issue, as the John Turner story shows. I don't think there are more than a tiny fraction of the country who care about it, and those who do care about it, I think probably rather more would support it than would oppose it. It is again a question of the articulate classes and how much grief the Prime Minister is prepared to take. Mulroney is prepared to take not too much from them, and hence he has opted for continental trade over strategic defense. When looking into what Mulroney has in mind, what Canada is doing, and why Canada is taking this position on strategic defense, I wonder if I could steal an idea from the speaker who immediately preceded me and outline in just 4 points what I think an appropriate foreign policy for Canada ought to be. I think, in general, an appropriate foreign policy for Canada ought to be very modest, because we are not a very powerful country. But I think this foreign policy is one that that is not only one that would be satisfactory to Canadian conservatives, but in fact is one that really could be made to work, that could make Canada a valuable part of the Western alliance, that could contribute to not only our security, but that of our allies. The first is that Canada ought to have a very firm commitment to participation in the protection of the security of our most important trading partners, which is a long way of saying we should continue to support NATO, except we should support it not with the second smallest contribution after that of Luxembourg, actually third smallest if you include Iceland, which has no armed forces, but that we should support it in proportion to our resources. The second has to be, simply by the facts of our economic existence, an enthusiastic endorser of free trade, an enthusiastic propagandist for this, and a diehard advocate of spreading free trade system as far as possible. The third element of this agenda relates to the second part, which is an attempt to get third world involved in free market economics in order to expand the markets that are available to us. That means encouraging in every way that we can, and it's not that significant because our clout in international affairs is not so large, free market economics in the third world, and the development of sound microeconomic policies in those countries. The fourth point is, as all Western democracies find themselves committed to, we must take humanitarianism into account. We must be prepared to offer generously whenever there's a disaster such as that that has recently occurred in Northeastern Africa, and must also be always prepared to respond to individual human rights violations. Finally, we should take care of, we should put all of this within the context of maintaining friendly relations with the United States. Since what the United States tends largely to want from us is rhetorical support, since rhetorical support is very cheap indeed to deliver, we should always be prepared to do that. That the United States does not want the Canadian Marines to be sent to Nicaragua. It doesn't want Canada to twist Nicaragua's arm. It just wants us to say a few nasty things about Nicaragua. And we should always be prepared to do that, A, because they're true, and B, because you can please your most important friend by giving a speech in the United Nations. That seems to me to be a logical and sound thing to do. Sum up. Strategic defense is something that is more vital to Canadian security than to American, more vital to Western European security than to Canadian, because its effect will be to protect, to make more credible, or to make credible again, the American guarantee of the security of its allies. It is, anyway, a matter of inevitability. And Canada, I think wrongly, has seen, or the Canadian, present Canadian political leadership has seen, I think wrongly, that it has had a choice of either supporting continental free trade or strategic defense. That's why the Mulroney government has not come out for strategic defense. I happen to think that that's a wrong choice. I'm not going to vex your patience by explaining in great detail why it is, except to say Mulroney is taking in the press right now as much abuse as there is for him. If he did a few more right things, it wouldn't be any matter. Thank you.